1.
You are going to hear a conversation among Dr. Archer, Larry, and Judy, talking about the new term.
First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6.
Okay, everybody. Welcome back to the new term. I hope you've all had a good break and that you're keen to start on your research project. What I'd like to do this morning is to give you a chance to ask questions about the project, requirements, ways of approach, how to get help if you need it. Today is informal. It may be already written on paper, but it's nice to have an opportunity to have it confirmed. So, any questions?
Dr. Archer, is there a confirmed due date yet to hand it in?
Yes, I can now confirm that it's 16th of July, not 15th, as first advised. Okay?
And what about the word limit?
Well, there is some flexibility on this, but in general, it's 8,000 to 10,000 words.
Ah, I see.
And you can choose your topic, anything from years 2 and 3. Yes?
I still can't work out what I want to do it on.
In that case, you should see your course tutor to agree on your final topic, and you should also be aware that there is special assistance available at the library on library resources if you need help on that.
Can I just check on the deadlines for everything?
Certainly. Look, let me write it on the board when each stage should be completed. First of all, you've got to work on your basic project outline, and that's due in to your course tutor by 21st of February. Which is only 2 weeks away, so you need to get cracking on that.
Do we have to include a full reference list by then too?
No, your reference list is due on 6th of April, which is 1 week later, so you have time to discuss this with your tutor.
And when should we be doing the research?
Well, that's over a 1 month period, essentially April to May.
And the write-up?
Well, you need to do quite a bit of research before you get going on your writing. So that's really May to July, with a due date for handing in on the 16th. Any more questions?
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
Well, sir, just some advice, really. It's about the research approach. Would you advise us to use some case studies?
Well, Larry, I know these can be difficult to arrange sometimes, but I really feel they are of great benefit in this subject. You can always talk to your tutor if you're having difficulty. Yes?
I've looked over some previous research projects that are in the library.
Is that a good idea, sir? I heard.
OK. I don't think you should go through them in detail, especially at this early stage, or you might end up being influenced by them more than you realise. But yes, it really is about the best guide you can have to what's required to what's expected in this type of project.
Sorry, Judy, I butted in on you.
That's all right. It's just that I noticed one project was a joint one. They work together as a pair. Is that a good idea?
Yes, I remember that paper. Working in a pair can have some advantages, but to be frank, this is meant to be an individual project, so it's best to work on your own.
About using subjects, is it okay if we use family members?
Your own relatives? I don't see why not. They probably offer some advantages in terms of availability. Although you need to guard against possible effects on your research outcomes. So, you can if you want. Perhaps you should discuss this with your tutor if you plan to use relatives, so you can approach it in the best way.
Okay, thanks.
Okay then. Well, I hope we've been able to sort out a few things. You're welcome to see me at any time, or drop me a note if you have any more queries.
Fine, thanks.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You are going to hear a talk on ginseng. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 14. Now listen to the tape and answer the questions.
Good morning. Today we'd like to talk with Mr. Schumacher of Kaiser Farms. Mr. Schumacher, what is in ginseng that makes it so special?
Thanks. The key elements in ginseng are the active ingredients known as ginsengosides. All true ginseng products on the market contain a certain percentage of ginsengosides, and a number of factors determine how much. The age of Wisconsin ginseng when harvested plays a major role in determining the natural level of ginsengosides. Tests have shown that the older the plant, the higher the ginsengoside content. 5-year-old Wisconsin ginseng plants have had ginsengoside levels as high as 20%. As a family operation, one of our strategies in producing the highest quality product available is to only harvest 4- and 5-year-old roots. The majority of Wisconsin ginseng harvested is 3 years old. The reason for this is that the expenses to care for and the possibility of disease increase as the plants become older. By limiting the amount of ginseng that we plant each year, we are able to provide the necessary attention and care to produce the highest quality 4- and 5-year-old roots.
Now look at questions 15 to 20. As the talk continues, answer questions 15 to 20.
What is Wisconsin ginseng used for?
There are two real species of ginseng on the market today, Panax, Korean or Chinese, and Panax, quinquefolius, Wisconsin. Since ginseng has been used for thousands of years in China, it is easiest to explain the differences in ginseng by using traditional Chinese herbal philosophy. Wisconsin ginseng is considered a cooling-type herb, and Korean or Chinese ginseng are considered heating-type herbs. As a cooling herb, Wisconsin ginseng is used as a preventative medicine. Here in the United States, Wisconsin ginseng is considered an adaptogen. As an adaptogen, Wisconsin ginseng acts to normalize body functions and strengthen the immune system and other systems in the body. Over a longer period of time, it builds up energy and maintains the body at a higher level, acting to reduce stress and fatigue. As a heating herb, Panax ginseng is used more as a stimulant and is often prescribed in China when the body is recovering from an illness and is worn down and in need of a rapid boost of energy. It is only recommended to be taken over short periods of time and not continuously. Wisconsin ginseng is considered the premier ginseng in China because it can be taken on a continuous basis and acts as a preventative type medicine by slowly building up the body. Wisconsin ginseng fits in perfectly with the Chinese herbal philosophy of preventative type medicine. Unlike here in the US, where we often wait until we are ill to seek medical attention, the traditional Chinese medicinal philosophy concentrates on building up the body to prevent illness. Based on the way Wisconsin ginseng has been prescribed in China, it is the correct ginseng to be taken for the majority of the consumers. Travel to China and see firsthand the ginseng that is considered the world's finest ginseng.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear a conversation between two students, David and Claire. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Hi, David. How are you going with your history studies?
Very well. I've actually finished it.
That's great. What era did you write on?
I researched Roman London, something I never thought I'd be interested in.
That sounds interesting.
I wanted to tie it into the work I've been doing on engineering, and I found it fascinating. And learned many things along the way.
Such as?
Well, although there were prehistoric settlements throughout the vast area now called London, strangely enough, no evidence has yet been found for any such community at the northern end of London Bridge, where the present city grew up.
The origins of London lie in Roman times, right?
Right. When the Romans invaded Britain in 43 AD, they moved north from the Kentish coast and traversed the Thames in the London region, clashing with the local tribesmen just to the north. It has been suggested that the soldiers crossed the river at Lambeth, but it was further downstream that they built a permanent wooden bridge, just east of the present London Bridge, in more settled times some 7 years later. As a focal point of the Roman road system, it was the bridge which attracted settlers and led to London's inevitable growth.
So London Bridge has been there for hundreds of years?
Yes, and though the regularity of London's original street grid may indicate that the initial inhabitants were the military, trade and commerce soon followed. The London Thames was deep and still within the tidal zone, an ideal place for the berthing of ships.
What other industry did they have?
Well, as the area was also well-drained and low-lying, it was geologically suitable for brick-making. There was soon a flourishing city called Londinium in the area where the monument now stands.
Londinium? That's Latin.
That's what I thought too, but the name itself is Celtic, not Latin, and may originally have referred merely to a previous farmstead on the site.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Wasn't London burned to the ground at some stage?
It happened in AD 60 by the forces of Queen Boudica of the Iceni tribe from modern Norfolk when she led a major revolt against Roman rule. The governor, Suetonius Paulinus, who was busy exterminating the Druids in North Wales, marched his troops south in an attempt to save London, but seeing the size of Boudicca's approaching army, decided he could not mount an adequate defence and evacuated the city instead. Not everyone managed to escape, though, and many were massacred.
What about the beautiful old architecture? Did you research that too?
I sure did. The major symbol of Roman rule was the temple of the imperial cult. Emperor worship was administered by the provincial council, whose headquarters appear to have been in London by AD 100. A member of its staff, named Anencletus, buried his wife on Ludgate Hill around this time. Pagan worship flourished within the cosmopolitan city. A temple to the mysterious eastern god Mithras was found at Bucklersbury House and is displayed nearby.
I quite like St. Paul's.
Traditionally, St. Paul's Cathedral stands on the site of a temple of Diana. Other significant buildings also began to appear in the late 1st century, at a time when the city was expanding rapidly. The Forum, a marketplace and basilica which housed the law courts complex at Leadenhall Market, was erected and then quickly replanned as the largest such complex north of the Alps. The Forum was much bigger than today's Trafalgar Square.
Who was in charge of all the town planning at the time?
Procurator Agricola. He encouraged the use of bathhouses and had a grand public suite made, which has now been excavated in Upper Thames Street. They were as much a social venue as a place to bathe. There was a smaller version at Cheapside, and in later centuries, private bathhouses were also built. Another popular attraction was the wooden amphitheatre, erected on the northwestern outskirts of the city. It's possible that gladiatorial shows were put on here, though lesser public sports, like bear baiting, may have been more regular.
I thought that happened mainly in the Colosseum in Rome, but I guess London being settled by the Romans explains their lust for blood.
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
Well, it's the beginning of the digital age, and technology is all set to completely revolutionise the way we watch TV, videos and DVDs, and play computer games at home.
First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Well, it's the beginning of the digital age, and technology is all set to completely revolutionise the way we watch TV, videos and DVDs, and play computer games at home. Here to tell us more about how we will be spending our leisure time at home in future is Anna Zabel.
Hello. Yes. There will be huge changes in the way we use television, radio, and new media in future. By this, I mean we will be able to do what we want, where we want, and when we want. The result is that our homes will increasingly become home theatres. And all our entertainment at home will be available at the touch of a button. Now, most home entertainment these days is delivered over wires, but this is changing thanks to high-speed broadband. Downloading will become easier, and studios will eventually release movies, songs, and video games directly to the consumer. So, for example, instead of a film opening on the big screen and eventually appearing on television, video, and the internet, it can appear in all formats at once. This means that we will have more choice and control over the media we use.
So, how will we use this media in our homes in future?
There will be big changes in how we watch video and television. Several research groups and companies are trying to add depth to TV and other video displays in the form of a third dimension.
So television and video screens will have depth. What do you mean by depth exactly? Do you mean 3D, like a hologram?
That's right. When we say that a hologram has three dimensions, it means that we can see not only up and down and left and right, but forwards and backwards too. When we talk about dimensions, we call forwards and backwards depth. So when we say that a hologram has three dimensions, it means we can see up and down and left and right, just like a picture or photo. But we can also look into the hologram because the image it contains has depth.
So instead of watching films on a flat screen, we will be watching them in 3D.
Absolutely. Well, as we live in a 3D world, we shouldn't really be watching television and films in 2D. And the technology to make this happen is already there. 3D screens are being developed which can be placed throughout the house, even in busy areas of our homes, like doorways and halls. Now, these screens appear to float in air. So in the future, 3D holographic images will be sent into our homes and we will be able to experience the action as if it is taking place right in front of our eyes.
So, the action won't just look real, it will be real. Incredible! How does this technology work?
Well, to get true 3D, each of your eyes has to see a slightly different image. 3D screens interweave multiple images in vertical stripes using special coatings and filters built into the screen. This means that each eye sees a different set of stripes. These screens are called lenticular screens. Now, these screens are easy to produce and some laptop PCs and cell phones already have them. However, lenticular screens do have one disadvantage. The strain on the eyes and brain of putting together a 3D image from two flat ones can result in headaches and dizziness. But a few companies have developed a hologram 3D display which does not cause these problems. Instead of building images, then leaving them to the brain to put together, holograms create a whole image that reaches the eye exactly the way light from a real object does. You can even walk part of the way around a holographic image to see side and back views, just as you would do if the object was right in front of you. Twin holograms will let a couple watch two different programs on the same screen, even if they sit next to each other on the living room sofa.
So no more arguing about which program to watch.
That's right. Patio screens are being developed too.
Patio screens? What are they exactly?
Well, a patio screen is a big inflatable screen, which means you can take it outside your home and watch a film in your garden. Some patio screens are even equipped with DVD players, and some new ones may even have a wireless connection.
Amazing developments there. Well, join us after the break when we will be talking.
That is the end of part 4.